Hello and welcome to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Sam Wong here, founder of the Princeton Election Consortium, professor of neuroscience at Princeton University, and faculty associate in law and public affairs.
So, Sam, these are interesting times for American conservatism, for the Republican Party, for both parties, really, as they struggle to find their footing in some ways after what was a major and some say unprecedented election outcome. The election of Donald Trump certainly threw a monkey wrench or two in the political machine of conservatism. Many on the right were not sure what to make of what some are calling Trumpism and how this all fits in the movement that's been developing at least since the 1960s with Barry Goldwater's 1964 campaign against Lyndon Johnson and then, of course, the era of Ronald Reagan. So it's raising all kinds of important questions in intellectual circles, in journalistic circles, and obviously on Capitol Hill. So today we're delighted to be joined by Julius Krein, who is the founder and editor of a new journal called American Affairs, which was just featured in the New York Times and described as seeking to, quote, give intellectual heft and coherence to the amorphous ideology known, for lack of a better term, as Trumpism. He said that he wants to appeal to fans of foreign affairs, to Marxists, and try to explain and have good quality writing about what's going on and the ideology behind the new administration. And it's an alternative to some of the more established journals that are out there, such as the National Review. He's received praise from a number of writers and journalists across the political spectrum. So we thought in our effort to better understand Trumpism, for a term that's used out there, we are fortunate to have Julius Krein here with us to talk about what he's doing with this journal. So welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
So maybe we can just start by asking you a little bit what prompted you to launch a new and independent journal as opposed to working in some of the publications that are out there and what you're trying to do with American Affairs.
Sure. It really all happened very accidentally. It started a little over a year ago, actually, as a sort of predecessor blog, a very simple blogspot.com blog called the Journal of American Greatness, which really started when a group of friends and I had sort of written pieces at the time Trump was leading in the Republican primary polls and was, you know, people were starting to get really concerned about this. And the response from the conventional right was, you know, Trump is terrible because he's not a conservative. And all of us thought that this response completely missed the mark and that Trump was actually winning precisely because he was not a conventional conservative and that conventional conservatism no longer made any sense. So we wrote some pieces like that and we sent them to all our friends at the conventional conservative publications. And perhaps unsurprisingly, they weren't very interested in those. So we decided, all right, we'll start our own little blog and maybe we'll get 100 of our friends to read it and it'll be fun. And it turned out to be actually very popular. At one point, Peggy Noonan wrote about it, and it had, you know, really remarkable readership, much beyond anything we had really imagined. And it sort of proved that there was a lot of interest in this stuff. But it also, with the anonymous kind of silly little blog, it had kind of reached a ceiling. I think at a certain point, people are kind of like, all right, you know, who are you? Come out and join the debate in a sort of honest and open way. And we wanted to do that, and there was a lot of interest in putting together something a little bit more serious and a little bit more institutional to kind of bring together some of these different voices into articulating a new kind of message and a new agenda, perhaps for conservatism and perhaps behind a broader realignment of the old categories as well.
So you went to Harvard. You were born in the mid, your age has been in all the articles. So you were born in the mid-80s.
Yeah, seems to be a popular topic.
Mid-80s, though, you were kind of born in the middle of the Reagan administration, and you were in college and came of age during George W. Bush's administration. So how do you think, as someone who is really thinking hard about what Donald Trump represents to conservatism, how do you fit him in that trajectory that you've lived through, the Reagan, you know, Bush Senior, Bush Junior, where is Trump in this long history?
I think he's actually the first real break from the history in important ways. And even, I mean, if you go from Reagan through Clinton, Clinton famous, of course, for saying the era of big government is over or whatever, and kind of established a sort of neoliberalism on the left, whereas Reagan, the Bushes had created a neoliberalism of the right. And Obama, I think, actually did sincerely try to sort of combat that, but didn't really do it. And Trump is kind of the first real challenge we've had, especially on the right, to the conventional conservative economic policies on trade, for example, immigration, et cetera. Foreign policy, of course, criticized the Bushes very strongly. So I think he's actually a sharp rupture from what seems to be the long decade of the 1980s and 90s, where actually our politics was really very uniform in the most important ways.
So when you made the transition, I want to come back to the birth of your journal. I you've just said some very interesting things, but I just wanted to drill into that just a little bit more. When you and your pal started this up, it was an anonymous blog, and then you made the transition to a journal. There's two questions I have here. First is, to what extent did you get the reaction at the beginning that maybe you weren't on the level, that maybe this was, you know, a gag? Because Trump certainly at that time was not known as a real policy maven. So can you unpack that a little bit about your relationship? I mean, I've been reading these articles. They're pretty interesting. Your relationship to the fact that he doesn't have a reputation as being an idea guy.
Yeah, well, there's two parts to that. First, I would say actually the audience reaction, if anything, took it too seriously and didn't always appreciate the humor. But with respect to Trump,
was there an extent to which you were kidding?
Yeah, I think if you read the articles, especially and I'm referring to the blog.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of parody stuff on there, and a lot of kind of inside jokes and references to sort of philosophical themes that that all of us studied and find interesting. But and you know, also I would say we never, like many people, we didn't really expect Trump to win. And the journal itself, the new one, actually started, or we decided to start it thinking that Trump would lose and the Republican Party would sort of go back to Romney, Ryan, Reagan 9.0 and exclude all of this stuff and some of the serious critiques that were raised, however inarticulately, by Trump. And we wanted to try to develop them and preserve them a bit more. Anyway, then, of course, Trump won, and now it's a whole different set of challenges.
I see. So right. So before, there might have been a fun aspect to it, tongue in cheek, and now, but American affairs. Now you're serious as a heart attack. Is that right?
You know, the line between playful and serious is always more complex than it seems. But
okay, but we're not talking to Milo here, right?
Just to get to, well, no, but I think, you know, right. Philosophic playfulness in, you know, Socrates and Plato, for instance, okay. The more serious it is, the more playful it is. But anyway, with respect to Trump, I mean, it's a strange and interesting dynamic because, of course, the blog and the journal were provoked by Trump. I doubt either would exist had Trump not run and won, or certainly not run. But they're not taking any intellectual cues from Trump. We're not sort of looking at what Trump does and then fashioning our agenda based on that. We're setting out what we see as our own critique of a neoliberal agenda, an attempt to build kind of a better, maybe communitarian type of agenda. And certainly there's some overlap with Trump. He hit on some of these themes during the campaign, still does. But I really don't know, you know, what he's going to do. And, you know, it's not a Trumpian organ. Okay. It's its own thing. And to the extent they overlap, great. But
okay. So this is a little bit more like the American right, the conservative movement was ossified. Trump comes along, breaks it up, mixes everything up. And this is a chance for fresh ideas to actually come into the conversation so that the right can, what, revive itself? Is that, would that be a way to think about
exactly.
What you're doing?
We saw, you know, Trump clearly shattered a lot of the ossified ideas and showed that they weren't going to win anymore and they weren't motivating the Republican constituency anymore, and that their only adherents were a group of think tanks in Washington, D.C. that actually no voters really cared about. And we saw this as an opportunity to lay out some new ideas and see where they went. But as I think it was Bill Voegeli said something like, everyone thought Trump would lose and they would get to define Trumpism. But now the person who gets to define Trumpism is Trump. So what we're doing, if it ends up being Trumpism or not, that's up to Trump. But we're still going to do it.
So can you talk a little bit about what this Trumpism is to you, or just as important, you're saying you can disconnect yourself in some ways from him, and you think conservatism was ossified, and you make me think of the book by Ross Douthat that came out a while ago, The Grand New Party, or so, I can't remember. It was kind of calling for a new vision of Republican politics, and Salam also wrote that. What are you envisioning as a potentially new and exciting path for conservatism that breaks out of whatever the other path was of the last few decades?
Yeah, as I said, I see it as much more of a restoration of a kind of communitarian sense of conservatism.
And what do you mean by that?
I mean more of a focus on grounding the economy within the society, rather than treating the dictates of free market economics as the be-all and end-all of human happiness, or the only thing that matter to a well-functioning and prosperous society. And I would say, I mean, with respect to Douthat and the so-called reformicons, I mean, we're definitely moving in the same direction. I've joked with people that we're sort of radical reformicons. I think if I would offer a friendly criticism of them, it's that they still tried to do it within the old conservative paradigm, in which the solutions were all kind of based on less government rather than more. It was, a child tax credit is sort of their key policy thing. And I just don't think that's enough. And there are certain cases where, I'm perfectly content with more government intervention. Uh-huh. Doesn't mean just government intervention is always good, of course. You have to be serious about it and smart about it. Okay. But I'm perfectly content with more government intervention on issues such as trade policy and economic regulation and so on, where I think the reformicons would be much more hesitant about that.
Okay, so now let's get a little bit more concrete here. This communitarian conservatism has a certain appeal to it, to me anyway. And so if we talk about things like, say, workers who are left behind by national productivity gains in Rust Belt states, people who, by reason of family or other ties, have stayed in that area, and there they are not benefiting from the global increases in productivity that have happened nationally over the last 30, 40 years. Is this a target intellectually for what you're talking about?
It's definitely a target, yeah. And I would go even further and say I think a lot of the discussion has kind of been focused on the sort of left behind. And there's no doubt that there's a lot of that which is true. But I would ask even further, how well it's even working for the rest of society. I think it's become, especially on the right, there's kind of this sense where, well, all of our ideas are basically correct. It's just we need to make some kind of compromises for a few people in the Rust Belt that it's not working for. I actually think, it may be more fundamental and radical in that all of our ideas are not correct. And actually our trade policy is totally flawed. And we're not just fixing it to help a few people in the Rust Belt who doubtless need help, but we're actually, we need to fix it in order to make it work for everybody.
Could I ask you, related to that, why did you write an article, I think in your first issue it is, on James Burnham? Can you tell people who that is and why he was appealing to get this message across?
Yeah, so Burnham is an interesting figure. I mean, he begins his career as a Trotskyite Marxist, and over time, moves increasingly right until ends up as a founder of the National Review or co-founder of the National Review in 1955. Becomes a very hardline anti-Soviet person in foreign policy, and so on. But his early work, the one that I focused the most on, which I think is the most important personally, was written in 1941, called The Managerial Revolution, and basically he wrote it right at the time he was breaking away from communism, and it was kind of his explanation for why. And he argues that the development of economic history was not happening along the Marxist line, where we were moving towards socialism and ultimately to, the workers' paradise, but we were actually moving toward the direction of a new sort of exploitative society that he calls managerialism. And I think I was especially drawn to it because I don't think we spend a lot of time thinking about, what capitalism and free markets mean to us today. On the right, especially, there's just a sort of reflexive celebration of it without actually thinking how the capitalism of our time differs significantly, both practically and sort of philosophically, from the capitalism of Adam Smith or the American founding fathers. And I actually think a failure to recognize how a sort of capitalism of kind of large corporate cartels, for lack of a better word, or financialization is actually maybe harmful to the, you know, classical free market principles, and that conservatism's failure to understand that may have led it to a lot of its own sort of policy mistakes over the last several decades.
I want to unpack the idea of free markets a little bit. You mentioned trade as an example where this new kind of conservatism might be important. Strikes me that any set of rules on trade, that the idea of free trade is sort of a stated ideal, but there are always rules on trade. Every aspect of society has rules, and those rules then can set a broad outcome. So what is it about your point of view, those around you, that differs from this free trade approach? Because the free trade approach is, roughly speaking, as far as I can tell, create a large market. We had the U.S. Trade Representative of Obama on a few weeks ago, and he talked about the virtues of free trade and the steps backward that would arise from, say, walking away from TPP, walking away from NAFTA. So what would the outlines of American greatness and trade policy look like?
Yeah, I mean, my personal view is that actually, you know, free trade does not exist,
right?
At least in the sense of Adam Smith or, you know, David Ricardo free trade. You know, we're not selling wine and cloth anymore. And this stuff is old. I mean, oddly, like all this stuff has been discussed, you know, many times. Paul Krugman won his Nobel Prize, actually, rejecting the that was even Ricardo was long gone before then, but he was rejecting kind of the later economic models on free trade and showing why they don't work in a world of economies of scales and all that.
Natural asymmetries between countries.
Yeah, well, yeah, and what determines economic success now? You can create your own comparative advantage through mercantilistic economic policies, and that's what everyone else is doing. And I think we delude ourselves by presenting this ideological notion of free trade and thinking that's the goal. The real goal for everyone else is sort of protecting their, you know, the high value parts of the value chain for their own economies and their own workers. And that's what we should be doing too. And we should just be realistic about it. Now, that doesn't mean to me ripping up every trade agreement or something like that. But it's perfectly sensible to rethink them. And really, you know, NAFTA now is 20 plus years old, and the Mexican economy's changed a lot. So why should a trade agreement last forever anyway? So I'm much more just getting away from these ideological abstractions and constructs, and more just focusing on how do we maintain the high parts of the value chain from our workers in, frankly, a mercantilistic world, and just being more realistic about that.
Now, I know you're probably not partisan, at least explicitly, in what the journal is about. But how will you rectify these kinds of positions with the policies of a Republican Party that many would say, as you are saying, have been antithetical to some of these goals, whether it's a true free market or whether it's assistance to workers? Do you believe that the kind of party is on the verge of some radical break in economic policy that these articles in the journal and your ideas might resonate with? Because obviously you're not writing a journal for Democrats, or it's not positioning itself as a new journal of liberalism. So kind of how will that happen, that the Republican Party will change so much for where it's been in your lifetime since Ronald Reagan's presidency?
Well, on the Democrats, you might be surprised. They seem somewhat interested. But to the heart of the question, I mean, yeah, I agree with you. I don't think we're, you know, to say we're on the verge of radical change, especially among, Paul Ryan and the Republican Congress and the conventional sort of think tank intellectuals in D.C., we still have a long way to go on that. But that's, of course, why the journal needs to exist. If they all agreed with me, I wouldn't have to write it. So we'll see if we're successful in convincing anyone. And I think part of it is just a generational thing. As we get further and further away from Reagan, you know, the slogans about how great Reagan was and how we need to imitate Reagan they don't matter to me at all. I have all kinds of appreciation for the success he had and what he did, but why that should form the base of our policy doesn't matter. So I think there's things are turning. That's not to say we're on the verge of a new consensus, but there is movement, and hopefully the journal can contribute to it.
I see. So if you look back on the long scope of the history of political parties in the United States, it strikes me that about every 40 years or so, the issue positions of one party or the other party undergo some kind of shift where there's something that happens. Alliances shift or policy position shift, something changes. And so it sounds like what you'd like to be is part of shifting the Republican Party. Now, I want to put that in opposition to another thing that's been happening in recent politics, which is that polarization and people's partisan preferences become extremely stable. So if you look at the patterns of voting from election to election, those patterns have become more stable than ever. And for the last 20 years or so, the election on election change, let's take presidential elections, that pattern of voting has not changed very much. So California is reliably Democratic. Texas is reliably Republican. Wyoming is reliably Republican. And it's really, there's some small changes along the way. So part of what made Trump succeed is this party loyalty. For you to succeed, that party loyalty has to be unmoored from any commitment to what the Republican Party says it stands for. And so is the idea here to introduce new ideas on trade, introduce new ideas, and just ride on that partisan loyalty? Or is the idea that people thought this all along and you're tapping into it?
Well, I mean, part of what made Trump succeed may have been partisan loyalty, but part of what really made him succeed is that he flipped Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. And to do that, he had to get at least some people that voted for Obama to vote for him.
I see. So there's a few persuadables and he was able to pull him in.
He managed to do it. Now, I actually think it's a really interesting point on the sort of party loyalty and stability, because I would argue that actually it's happening because our politics gets much more shrill and polarized as we focus on kind of increasingly trivial, say, media-driven matters. So key issues like trade is not something that we even really discussed that much in the last 10 years. And there, you know, there was kind of a, at least, you know, there was always a sort of bipartisan consensus on trade, foreign policy, even I would say immigration to some extent, on also even on kind of taxes and stuff. There's a lot of fights over whether we have 39 or 35% tax rates, but you know, the big picture is broadly stable. And I would say that, you know, there's an interesting dynamic where the polarization expands as the weight of the issues decreases. And I think what we're seeing now is really an entire shift in the intellectual consensus, where the divide is no longer red and blue, Republican and Democrat, you know, Reagan versus Clinton or whatever. It's much more, you know, neoliberalism, which has, you know, the rightist expression in, say, George W. Bush or Mitt Romney, and the leftist expression in Hillary Clinton, versus, you know, for lack of a better word, communitarianism, which is, you know, on the left, at least, is kind of the Bernie Sanders sense of we need a much more sort of economically redistributionist or whatever, take care of our own citizens better approach. So, you know, again, that hasn't really manifested itself in the voting in the polls, but I think there's a sense in which we could be moving in that direction.
So let's take the word redistribution. Okay, you just said that in regard to feeling the burn. The Affordable Care Act was a massive redistribution from, roughly speaking, from upper classes to lower classes. We just found out a CBO score on the American Health Care Act, the Republican version of Obamacare repeal. And it seems to change the deficit in the next 10 years by $300 and some billion. So that means that if it's an undoing of the Affordable Care Act, therefore it's redistribution upward towards upper classes. So what's the stance of American Affairs regarding, I don't know, how Trump feels about that act or how you feel about that act? Unpack that one.
I think, you know, again, this is one of what many people have pointed out. It'd been nice if, you know, the journal existed before the candidates so that we could stake out these positions earlier. And I do have some articles scheduled for that for issue 3 later in the year. But, you know, I can give you my personal view. I don't think the current Republican proposal will work. I don't think it, you know, I'm not a big fan of it. My charitable interpretation is that they had to kind of throw something up there to make it look like they were doing something, but hopefully aren't that serious about it. But we'll see. I don't think it's really a solution to much. Now, to be fair, though, we have to say that Obamacare was also a big disappointment, and it was less of a redistribution. I mean, if you were in the so-called elite, you didn't really notice it very much because your company's paying for the healthcare anyway. You know, so the people that really it hurt were your kind of small business owners or people who are actually buying healthcare and, you know, the individual marketplace farmers, stuff like that. And they really saw a huge hit on their premiums. They, you know, they're paying much more for much worse care in many cases, or lower access to care. Though it certainly, it, you know, probably did help some people on the very low end of the spectrum.
25 million people.
Yeah. No, I'm not denying.
That's not. That's a lot of people.
I'm not, like I said, I'm not that. I think the problem with it is that it combines a lot of the, it combines all the costs of socialized medicine without all of the benefits, and all of the problems of free market medicine without all the benefits. I think realistically, to actually make it better, it's probably going to move, at least in some cases, more in the direction of socialized medicine. And I think the Republican
Party. You mean
like
single payer?
I don't know if it's single payer so much.
Jillian, did
it's
we get
controlling
a
costs?
Did we get a Democrat on the show by accident? What's going on here? No, no, I'm sorry. I'm pulling your leg a little bit, but I'm really interested.
No, I think this is one area where we've heard this for decades, that socialized medicine is the road to serfdom, and government involvement in healthcare is, you know, the biggest disaster and the jackboot of tyranny on everybody. And this is ideological blindness that has probably prevented us from having a much better approach to healthcare. And you know, who knows? I mean, to call it Obamacare is a bit of a misnomer, is really more like congressional Democrat care. But anyway, I think we should get over this. And the reality is, unless we're willing to actually deny people care because they're unwilling to pay for it, we're going to have universal health care. And the only question is, you know, do you have a sensible way to pay for that, which is going to involve some government involvement. And every serious person on the right who does health care, like Ovik Roth, if I'm pronouncing his name right, he read the preface to his thing. He acknowledges this completely. You know, we've had socialized health care in the U.S. for decades, but the Republican Party hasn't quite taken those conclusions to fruition yet, and they haven't, you know, been able to get over these ideological issues to actually do something sensible. So we'll see. We'll see where it goes. And of course, like, you can design really bad, you know, social medicine systems. It doesn't mean it's always going to work. But I think we do have to get over this. The only healthcare is free market healthcare, which I think is basically impossible and doesn't make any sense.
How will that? So the Journal is now connected to Trumpism, coming out during this presidency, and in all the coverage of your Journal, these have been connected, and you're positioning yourself as a, you know, national review of this era, the generating new ideas, even though the new candidate's in office. How do you deal with the other side of Donald Trump? And so there's been a lot of coverage of a part of this campaign that many Democrats and some Republicans found intolerable. Appeals to nativism and xenophobia and sexism. The refugee ban that came out early in his administration, and what that represented, allegations of voter fraud that are false but play into efforts to disenfranchise voters. All of this part of Donald Trump is Trumpism as well. And so how does your Journal, A, think about that part of this president and his campaign that came before, and how will you deal with all of this, which is out in the air right now, in American conservatism circa 2017?
Yeah. I've never actually described the Journal as a new national review. I would probably be more cliche and use, you know, a new public interest or something like that. And the difference is that, you know, we're not really interested in the day-to-day debates over the candidate and stuff like that. We're interested in putting out new ideas on trade policy and healthcare and whatever. And people will write for us who are very interested in those ideas and our approaches to them, but maybe don't like Trump at all and are not voting for Trump.
Is Judge Curiel an American?
Yes.
Okay. I'm just trying to get a feeling on, like, you know, not getting too wrapped up in the day to day. Who won?
But
the
I'm not gonna write a piece on, you know, I'll leave that to others to explore the Judge Curiel controversy.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just trying to get a feeling for, like, right? Because the thing is, people see the day to day, and the thing is, there are these deep issues that you're describing about whether it be, I don't know, trade or maybe border security. But in the meantime, things pop up in the news day to day, and that is an undeniable core part of what people see when they see the current president. So I'm just trying to really understand this a little bit. So, like,
yeah, sure.
Like the border wall. How about the border wall? Does that speak to American insecurities about what's going on there?
Yeah, I think I mean, I don't personally have any problem with the border wall. I think for the most part, it's kind of a symbolic thing, and it shows, you know, that Trump takes borders seriously and national citizenship seriously. In and of itself, of course, it's not going to solve all of our immigration problems. I mean, people overstaying visas or whatever, it's going to have no effect on that. It might have, you know, a little bit of an effect on smuggling or whatever. And it might, you know, create a few jobs for construction workers. So on the whole, I'm fine with it. It doesn't bother me, I think. But it's also, I don't really, you know, it's far from a sufficient piece of policy or really a serious piece of policy.
But what do you think? It was fair to ask William Buckley what he thought of the Birchers. And this came up all the time in the 50s till he separates himself. Now we have a president who many people would say embraces those extremist ideas. So what do you think of that part of Donald Trump? The comments on immigrants, the comments on women, as the editor and founder of this important journal, what do you have to say about that part of this president being and that those kinds of ideas being in the White House?
I mean, the comments on immigrant, I mean, you're referring to like the initial comments where he's
calling
saying,
them rapists and murderers.
Well, he said, you know, again, like,
and some I presume,
he said
good
some
people.
Of them. Yeah, yeah. He said some of them are rapists, which.
No, he said some of them are good people.
No, he said some of them are rapists, too. I mean, he didn't say all Mexicans are rapists. He said some of them are rapists, which is, of course, some Americans are rapists and some Danish people are probably racist. So obviously it was intended to be a provocative statement to get publicity, and it succeeded at that. Obviously, it can be interpreted in very uncharitable ways. But, you know, so far I really don't. If you really think Trump is a racist and out to impose really discriminatory, prejudicial policies on the country, there's probably nothing I can say to convince you otherwise. But enough Americans apparently thought that he wasn't, and he's the president. So, you know, I think we just have to try to come up with the best policy possible. If he does something that I would say, you know, really horrible and cross the line on a policy line, I would be happy to criticize it too, but so far I don't think he's done very much.
And then the other part that would be relevant, you're a Harvard graduate, studied with Harvey Mansfield, I believe I read, and you have a journal that's really committed to ideas, magazine, journal, whatever you want to call it. And there's the other critique of the Trump presidency that part of what he's doing is upending, you know, our understanding of knowledge. He is saying things that are untrue. He's kind of saying things off the cuff that have no basis in fact, and he's attacking ideas often if they are in opposition to him. So how do you get around that challenge of trying to be a serious voice of a new conservatism committed to ideas, which it really looks like you are, and it sounds like that's what you're trying to do, with a president who is simultaneously trying to upend that approach to debate and political discourse?
Yeah, I don't really think that Trump may have been the first to use Twitter as an effective political tool as a candidate, but he was far from the first person to devolve into the Twitter form of discourse. And certainly as far as I know, Trump is not sitting around reading, you know, Burke and Hayek and Leo Strauss or anybody else. But we can make fun of him. We can make fun of him for being, you know, simplistic and not that intelligent or whatever. But the fact is, he's the only person who presented, you know, ideas that had been completely ignored for a long time and won on them.
Yeah, but I think
and what were the great ideas? I mean, Jeb Bush is supposed to be so wonderful. He couldn't even articulate a response to the Iraq question, which you'd have to be an idiot to think you wouldn't be asked. And that stuff, you know, like, is Trump the first person to you know, say some things that are, you know, play with the truth a bit? I mean, I remember Clinton talking about a video causing the Benghazi riots, and, you know, I guess ultimately I don't really care about that stuff too much.
But we're talking about a density of statements. So it's unfair quantitatively to point at an extreme false statement and say, see, other people do it. But we're talking about things like ejecting multiple major media outlets from press conferences. We're talking about specifically saying
press
that
press conferences anyway. I mean, okay, press conferences are a joke, right? No news is made at press conferences.
But the sheer density, the
theater, right?
Yeah, but the sheer density of false statements about whether who won the popular vote, or about whether he's being wiretapped, or about whether his taxes are under audit, just on and on and on. So isn't there something about the density of that that strikes you as an intellectual as being a little dissonant with what you're trying to get done here?
Yeah, look, I would love if we had a wonderful civil public discourse, very high-minded. Trump certainly hasn't solved that or restored that if we ever had it. But I guess I have a hard time, you know, blaming Trump for all of it. I think the only solution to it is probably, for better or worse, more information rather than less. I mean, it's an interesting question as to how we kind of got to this point. I think the right, and I'd probably have to agree with them a little bit on this, is they would say that the, you know, mainstream outlets really kind of discredited themselves as mainstream outlets by becoming sort of overtly biased on politics. And there may be something to that. There may not be. But it certainly happened. And, you know, I don't see, to some extent, there's a sense in which Trump, by kind of totally embracing this, kind of brings the problem to the fore, and maybe we can confront it directly and rise from the ashes. I don't know. But ultimately, I think it's probably going to be solved by more information, not less. And we're going to try to, you know, we're committed to putting out long form 3,000 to 5,000 word essays on serious topics. Uh-huh. So we're doing our part to try to make it better.
Julian has, I'm going to hold the floor for one last question. I'm going to shut up for a moment. In the current Trump administration, cabinet officials, everybody, from your intellectual standpoint, who's your favorite member of the administration right now?
I would say a toss-up between Rex Tillerson and Wilbur Ross.
And why?
Well, I thought Wilbur Ross is a very interesting pick because on the one hand, he has – well, when I say good ideas on trade, I basically think he generally agrees with me, though we'll see. But at least willing to think outside again of this kind of free trade dogma and really look at how our trade relationship with China needs to be fixed, et cetera. At the same time, though, and again, I come from sort of a finance background. I mean, this is a figure that has tremendous respect in the financial community, in the business community. And when a lot of people, you know, attack him for kind of, oh, you're just a protectionist, you're not serious, you're some kind of ideologue, you know, they won't be able to do that with a figure of that stature. And I actually have a lot of respect for his experience and think that, you know, as Trump says, he may be able to make good deals. So we'll see. So I'm a fan of that one. And for similar reasons, I think Tillerson comes to foreign policy from less of an ideological perspective, less of this sense of, I mean, right now our sort of, when we talk about foreign policy studies and theory, it's basically like a bunch of people sitting around trying to classify people as, are you a realist? Are you a neocon? Are you a liberal interventionist? And it's all kind of silly. And they actually don't know anything. But Tillerson has, you know, I think a lot of on the ground experience in, you know, dealing with a number of countries that are of critical importance to us, China, Russia, et cetera. And I think not having that ideological baggage could be helpful. Now, at the same time, he has to run a government department, and a lack of experience with that, of course, could be a challenge as well. So, you know, nobody's perfect.
Well, let me turn away from Trump as we have our final few minutes. Other than, so in the 50s, the issues that animated someone like Buckley were anti-communism, lowering or weakening the progressive tax system and deregulation. Then the unintended consequences of social policy became a bigger theme in the 60s and 70s with President Bush. In that era of conservatism, a lot of it was in the end after 9/11 about how to combat terrorism. Other than free trade, which you've talked about a lot now and has been central, I think, to the Trump campaign, what are like three other big issues that you as a younger conservative or whatever term you want to use would like the journal to focus on in the coming year that you think deserve more debate, deserve more attention, and deserve a fresh approach other than the kinds of alternatives that have been out there on these issues?
Well, to identify it in sort of specific policy issues, trade is one, foreign policy is one, and, you know, probably just the general, the questions of regulation and deregulation. And what I mean by that specifically is we've had, as I state in my essay, we've had a unique situation in the past, you know, several decades where on the one hand, the amount of the regulatory state apparatus has grown tremendously, but at the same time, the sort of democratic institutions like Congress specifically have been weakened, and democratic accountability is much weaker. So I don't think the issue is sort of more regulation or less, as the conventional left-right divide has it, but whether the regulatory authorities are democratically grounded in the voters. So those would be three of the top ones. And I think, again, the larger overriding theme is, you know, is the economy going to be grounded in the society or not? And the challenge to the right from that is fairly simple. But the challenge to the left on it is, you know, who I think are generally sympathetic to that notion. But the challenge to them right now is, well, can you ground the economy into a society if you're unwilling to sort of recognize or defend a society? That's where you get into the issues like borders and national sovereignty and all that.
And on foreign policy, what do you mean? What kinds of things are you thinking of?
Well, to use a term that's often ill-defined and simultaneously extremely cliche, I think it's kind of redefining realism and restoring this notion that our foreign policy should be grounded in sort of very concrete national interests. I think what's happened on the right, with the outcome of the Bush administration, a lot of it I think was unintentional, is that after WMD were not found in Iraq, they had to kind of come up with another justification, and it became the whole sort of democracy agenda and all that, which meant that, you know, we could no longer really talk about what our national interests were in these things anymore. And so I think there's a bit of work to be done to recover that on the right. And then on the left, you know, they don't call it democracy promotion. They call it responsibility to protect or whatever. But it kind of leads to the same things. And you can have all the good intentions in the world, but if the outcome has what we have seen in Iraq and Libya and everywhere else, you know, we need to have a more realist approach, I think.
So all these stances, putting them all together, as you build this new journal, American Affairs, who's been supporting you? Who's been helping you get off the ground here in terms of building an organization, you know, financing it, just getting the whole thing put together, going from an anonymous blog to a thing that evidently I can pay and get PDFs?
Even print issues. If you're
I'm almost there, but let's see. But just who's financing it, and who's like helping you get off the ground here?
Yeah, I think it's on our website. You can see the members of the advisory board, which include people like Mike Lind, who you know describes himself as a radical centrist or something like that, to people like Rusty Reno, who you know is editor of First Things, a kind of traditional social conservative kind of Catholic publication, to people like Yoram Hazoni, who is a kind of leading intellectual in Israel. And you'll see, you know, there's a few other names there. I can never remember them all.
And these guys wrote the checks?
I'm sorry?
These guys wrote the checks?
I think, you know, if anyone I haven't discussed with the donors the level of public disclosure. I think if somebody wants to do a little reporting on the advisory board, you'll figure out probably who wrote the big checks. But in general, I was actually very surprised to see, for the most part, they were kind of conventional Republican donors who maybe independently or simultaneously had started to come to the same conclusions, or at least be very agreeable to the kind of approach you're putting out.
And when they listen to this podcast and they hear the phrase socialized medicine, how do you think those checks are going to – you think there's
going to – I talked to them about that one before we got started.
All right.
Well, I want to thank you for joining the show. This is actually a terrific conversation. And I want to thank you, Julius Krein, founder and editor of American Affairs, which you can now find online or subscribe to PDF or real version on paper. But thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls. Talk to you soon.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.